Welcome to Amnesty International's comedy podcast series. This year, Amnesty's had exclusive backstage access at two of the biggest events on the comedy calendar, the 2014 Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the Balham Comedy Festival in London. We'll be bringing you a series of interviews with some of the greatest stand-up comedians working today, and along with finding out about the business of laughter, we'll be chatting about life, politics, and human rights. Today, we're backstage at the Balham Comedy Festival in London with the renowned comedian and satirist Marcus Brigstocke. He'll be chatting about press intrusion, performing on crutches, and his first time on stage. Marcus Brigstocke, thank you for joining Amnesty International backstage at the Balham Comedy Festival. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. Yeah, I'm very well.
And we saw your show, Je M'Accuse, the other day. Mm. And can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, I've written a new show, which is fantastically indulgent because it's all about me. I've knocked on the head for the time being the satire, the raging, ranting and spitting tacks at the world in favour of telling stupid stories about myself. And while I've done that, we've seen the soft rise of fascism across Europe. UKIP and Le Front National have risen to power. So it just goes to show, you know, how much work I was doing to keep that at bay. But no, the show's fun and it's a little bit confessional, but not really. And it explores the trivial aspects of my life and then probably the most profound and important part of my life so far at the end.
And we saw it last year, but this year it's been developed to include, I don't want to give away the ending, but you know, an excellent dance
there
routine.
There was a very big part of my life. I went through a very profound change when I was 17 years old, which, to cut a long story short, involved me halving my body weight in less than 7 months. And after that, I became a podium dancer. And at the end of the show, I attempt to recreate some of my early 90s shape throwing. It's fun. It's a fun way to do the show.
I'm pretty sure you got a standing ovation, didn't you, from...
I did. They like my shape throwing, yeah.
Well, I was very impressed, and it was all 90s music, which was very nostalgic for me. But your show has been marred by injury.
I did the show last year at the Edinburgh Festival, and during the second show, I was so excited that I snapped my Achilles tendon during the show and then had to do the remainder of the run on crutches, and then kind of got over that, ready for this year, and I'm touring the show any minute, and I snapped my cruciate ligament going off a ski jump in January. Wow. So, yeah, I've been injured since this whole thing began, but still doing it. It's still fun.
That was on The Jump, wasn't it?
That was on The Jump, yeah. My first reality show, which was an odd experience.
But is it first and last?
Amazing. well, no. I mean, if I was offered something like The Jump again, I'd do it in a heartbeat. It was unbelievable.
Even though you're still in recovery?
Yeah. It'll be 9 months before I'm fully able to walk again. And, you know, it was well worth it, man. I did skeleton bobsleigh, two-man bob, speed skating, speed skiing, downhill, dual slalom, everything. It was incredible. I was trained by Olympians. What a lucky man.
But so you must have been on crutches for quite a bit. How was your microphone technique?
Mixed. It was difficult to be on crutches and use a microphone. It was all right. I left the mic in the stand and then I just kind of bust it and stood on one leg for a month.
Classic.
Yeah. I'm such a trooper. Do you see what I go through? Amnesty.
So if I could take you back to the early days of Marcus Brigstocke, when did your interest in comedy first begin?
Interesting comedy. From a kid, I mean, from my earliest memories are sitting watching the two Ronnies and then Not the 9 o'clock News and the Young Ones and, you know, just anything that made me laugh. And it was, amazing. Hmm. And I, even as a child, I could remember great chunks of script. And then it was years later before I sort of put together the idea, oh, that's maybe a thing that I could do. I knew Raw and Delirious by Eddie Murphy. I could do the whole thing. I knew the whole of Robin Williams Live at the Met. And I hadn't studied them. I just watched them and went, that's funny. It's gone in. And then a friend of mine said to me, you should do comedy. And that was it. Mm. So, and it's a, you know, it's a beautiful job. There are downsides to it. You spend a lot of time on your own and the writing's difficult and you occasionally have bad gigs, but it's a beautiful thing to do, to make people laugh. It's a pleasure.
Can you remember the first time you approached that microphone in front of a live audience? How did
it
go?
I remember it well. It was a mixed bag. It was a I was booked for a comedy competition run by Kiss FM, and it was a club in Holborn, and I was booked for 7 minutes, and the first 4 minutes I died on my ass. It was horrific. And then I ran out of all the props and stupid stuff that I'd come up with and started actually talking and being myself and all the rest of it, and I turned it round. And that, weirdly, that gig is probably one of the most dramatic turnarounds I've ever managed.
Really?
And again, turning a gig round once you've stunk the room out is really difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
I turned it round, and I tell you what, I remember this. I walked off that stage from the first gig going, if I can do this for the rest of my life, I'll be happy. This is incredible.
And they say
that was first gig.
Your first one's always the worst, they say, so it only gets better.
4 minutes of it sucked and 3 minutes were good, so...
And would you say your comedy has changed over the years?
Yeah, massively. And it keeps changing as well. And I, you know, I've always, I'm not purist about it. And I don't, I kind of resent the way in which people need the people whose work they like to exist in one place. Mm. I've been doing satirical, topical, angry, ranty stuff for a long time now. Before that, I didn't do any. While I've done that, I've written very silly sketch shows, children's stuff. I've done Giles Wembley Hogg Goes Off, which is sort of a satire in a way, but mostly just a bunch of silly jokes. So for me, you know, I write about the thing that captures my attention at the time. And I suppose it's not surprising, having turned 40 last year, that I would be a bit introspective and want to say some things about myself while I figure all of that out at a changing time in my life. And the satirical stuff just goes on and on for me, because the world needs people to yell at it.
Mm. And as you say, I mean, over the years, your comedy has been politically charged.
Yeah.
In other countries around the world, many comedians use this tool to say something important about the ruling regime.
Yeah.
Do you think it's important for comedy to try and change or inform people's thinking?
Yes, I think it's very important. I don't know whether, as an ambition, a comedian should set to change people's thinking, but I think if that's somewhere in there, that's fine. I suppose for me, it's about exposing ideas that, with even a small amount of examination, fall apart.
Hmm.
Racism, homophobia, sexism are quite easy just to undo, because you can just go, but you're a sentence, you're one sentence away from all your nonsense being exploded, because it's nonsense. It's demonstrably nonsense. And if you can make people laugh about that stuff, then I think you are saying, look, here's a silly thing. Let's hold this up. Let's shake all the rubbish out of it and see what's left. And the answer is usually nothing.
Mm.
So, yeah, you know, I think that... I think that as part of a narrative of any healthy democracy, or even, you know, outside of democracy at the moment, it's really important for people to find expression. Mm. And if that happens to be in comedy, all to the good.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the pluses for me with comedy is I know if I write a really great joke, people will remember it. And if that joke happens to be about something, then they've remembered the thing. Mm. I mean, that's not my aim. My aim is just make them laugh. But if there happens to be something in there where they're like, ah, ha, ha, then, you know.
And I mean, you work on the Now Show, of course, don't you?
Yeah.
So that reaches, you know,
about 3 million people. Yeah.
So it's a wide ranging.
It's big. I'm doing a new show called The Briggs Society, which I did last year, and I'm writing a new series right now. And that's an interesting challenge, because the idea is I promote myself into a position I wouldn't have. So I've been a drug dealer. I've been an MEP. This week I'm running a farm. I'm going to be head of the Bank of England. And the idea of doing that is, as a stand-up, I exist outside and I go, that's rubbish. He's stupid. She's doing that badly. Right? But if you put yourself in the position of responsibility in the thing, you suddenly go, why is that difficult?
Hmm.
Wait a minute. Because I'm pro-European, right?
Mm.
But only because I'm an optimist. I mean, it's rubbish. It's appalling, right? But it's the most ambitious democratic project any person has ever attempted since two blokes looked at a rock and went, should we lift this up together? Right? It is, it's incredible. But they're about to pass the TTIP, the trade, transatlantic trade thing, that will just destroy a huge number of things that we think are really, really important. So I'm doing a show where I go in and look at nuance and look at... hopefully both sides of an argument and go, but you know what, the anti-Europeans, for all that I think they're batshit crazy, if they're talking about this, then I agree with them, or you know, whatever it may be. If you're a drug dealer, I think you're scum actually, because you're probably committing people to a life that is spiraling out of control, and you'll be responsible for some deaths as well. But at the same time, the illegality of drugs, so it's kind of going in and looking at that. It's difficult.
So it's a good insight into the kind of people you would normally attack on stage.
Exactly. Yeah. And just try and be them for a day. Yeah. I mean, ask yourself, what would it be like to be a politician? You know, I mean, I shout them down all the time. That's my job. And I'm not going to stop just because I understand how difficult it is. But it is difficult. Mm. It's so really difficult.
When can we expect to see this on TV?
It's on Radio 4 and it starts in August. And it's on for 6 weeks on Friday evenings. So,
And you have done so much in your career. I mean, radio, television, theatre. What else is on your list? I hear you'd like to say you'd make a UK version of The Daily Show.
Yeah, that's always been an ambition. It saddens me. It saddens me that I'm not making it, but it saddens me more, actually, that we don't have one. Mm. We should have The Daily Show, or at the very least, we should have a version of what John Oliver is now making in the States, a weekly show, which is truly excellent. I made one called The Late Edition, and, you know, with scant resources, we did a great job. Mm. We really did. But we should have a daily show. Mm. There's no reason why not. I'm also in a campaign at the moment to change the laws about licensing of material from the Palace of Westminster. Mm. You can only see debates from the Palace of Westminster on the news. Right, you've never seen a clip on Have I Got News For You. You've never seen it on Mock the Week or on my show or anywhere else.
Just not allowed.
We're not allowed.
Right.
And that's, we pay for the Palace of Westminster and we pay for them to debate on our behalf. The debate, the material, and they in that role belong to us. Mm. And so that should be satirable, in my opinion. And I don't think that that would... convince people that politicians are worthless. I think actually it would engage people more closely in that. So I'm trying to achieve that.
Because they do it in other countries, don't they? But
yeah, in the States you can have whatever you want, you know.
So Amnesty International defends and promotes freedom of expression, but the press often use the right as a defence for their stories. Now, having been on the receiving end of tabloid intrusion occasionally, do you think they should be more tightly regulated?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I'm a keen supporter of Hacked Off. And here's why. It seemed apparent to everybody that an inquiry needed to happen because everybody, including the press, went, yeah, this has gone a bit bad. So they appointed a judge, Lord Justice Leveson, and nobody said, that guy, that crazy old loon, that anti-democratic, that anti-press nutcase, that left-wing lunatic, that stifler of the freedom of speech, everyone went, yeah, okay. All right, he seems like a good guy. And he listened to 16 months of evidence and submitted a report, fully aware of what the consequences of that report would be because he's a judge and he got there. And it seems to me he got there through very legitimate means. I can't think at the moment of a person I'd be more inclined to listen to than that guy. Hmm. Why would I? So I would be all right with some regulation of our press. And I don't buy the hysterical arguments, and I resent them being used by the press to suggest that they will forever be at the beck and call of government and all the rest of it. Mm. So for that reason, I support Hacked Off, and I would like to see Leveson's recommendations enacted in full.
And talking of the tabloid press, they seem to be regularly bashing human rights. Can you tell me why you think human rights are important?
Oh, because I'm a human. I'm selfish. I'm a human. That's why human rights are important. I'm one. If you are, then your rights, I suppose, are important as well, but not as important as mine. It is pretty damn simple, actually. You know, I mean, I suppose the way that we define those rights needs nuance. It needs subtlety. It needs clear thought and all the rest of it. But the right for freedom of expression, the right for freedom of religious practice, much as it irks me, the right to love who you want to love, marry who you want to marry. It seems to me perfectly obvious that the same rules should apply to everybody, and that those rules should be wherever possible, just to make it easy for people to exist and do the thing they do. We're responsible in a society for each other, and for where we need to, regulating the way in which the choices we make might hurt other people. That's the role of a society. But fundamentally, it just seems obvious to me. But then it would, you see, because I live in the UK and we're lucky here. We're really lucky. Like comedians here especially. I said this the last time I spoke to Amnesty. We really do have freedom of expression. We really do. There is nothing you cannot talk about. I wish comedians took more responsibility for the choices they made, and if they blunder into a subject that matters to people, make their own choices about what they're going to not say, because that's really important. But there's nothing you can't say in the UK. We're really, really lucky.
Is there anything you've regretted joking about?
Actually, there is. I made a very... I used to end my show years ago with a thing. This is before 2000. I used to say, as we approach the millennium, you know, it can be scary for everybody. And, you know, we'll be all right. I suppose the key thing to remember is never forget Noel Edmonds killed a man. Thank you and good night. And I walked off stage and it always got a laugh, you know. And then one night I was in a bar. And a guy came up to me and went, "That was my dad."
Wow.
And I went, what do you mean? Who was your dad? And he went, the guy that died on the Late Late Breakfast Show, I think it was. And I just went, yuck. Yeah. And I offered to buy him a drink and he said no. And he walked away. And then about 20 minutes later, he came up and he went, "Yeah, go on then, buy me a drink." And we sat and talked and all the rest of it. And I'm very glad we did. And I still make jokes, I'm sure, where the victim is somewhat undeserving, but it gave me pause for thought.
Yeah.
Because somewhere the trivial things you say, they could really hurt somebody, and I think that really matters. Sometimes you say a thing that will offend a person profoundly.
Yeah.
And they may cry, they may be very upset, they may be very angry, they may want to physically hurt me, and I'm fine with that. That's fine. But the ones that are a bit thoughtless and just a little jab into nowhere, they matter. You know, so I try to be careful about that stuff. There's plenty of things I regret.
Yeah,
plenty. I thought I'd done enough research to talk about a single aspect of Judaism. It was something Christopher Hitchens had believed. So I thought, well, if Hitch does, good enough for me. And it turned out to be entirely wrong, and part of an ongoing anti-Semitic thing. Yeah. And I said it. It got broadcast, and then some Jewish people went no. And so I had to apologize in the Jewish Chronicle, which I did very quickly. And I was genuinely sorry for helping to support, an ugly myth that wasn't true. It's important.
But I think it's good that you're aware of the effect that
you
could have.
You have to be. Yeah. It's important. And look, I'm not going to get it all right. And also, I will change my mind about things. You know, things that I was politically absolutely sure of, I will change my mind as circumstances change and all the rest of it. But the responsibility is important. You know, I don't think that freedom of expression is a privilege as such, but I do think it's special. I do think it's something that you need to treat with respect.
Yeah. And Amnesty International has just launched its Global Stop Torture campaign. As part of a survey carried out, we discovered that more than a third of people thought torture was justified in certain circumstances.
Kiefer Sutherland.
Does that surprise
Kiefer.
You?
Kiefer is to blame for this. Single-handedly, Kiefer Sutherland did this.
The 24
I watched
effect.
24, yeah. And I loved season 1 of 24. It was about the most exciting thing ever. But then it made me aware of something. If you already know the guy's a bad guy, you will watch and you will go, whatever you need to do to that prick is fine with me, because I already know he's a bad guy. But what if in the real world the assumption is we already know you're a bad guy.
Mm.
That's not okay. And Kiefer Sutherland, and he produced the show. It's why I keep saying his name. He produced the show as well as starring in it. Crossed a line. The US military wrote to Fox and said, we have a problem with GIs showing up thinking they're allowed to do stuff because they've seen 24.
Hmm.
You know, it's obviously not just Kiefer Sutherland, but that's worrying.
Hmm.
You know, we do live in times where, for example, Hamas have the stated case. They would like to drive the Jews into the sea and exterminate all of them. So for all Israel's behavior sickens me, they are dealing with an enemy who would like to kill all of them. That's really difficult. It's really complicated, nuanced stuff. Torture won't make it any less complicated. Mm. Torture won't make it any less nuanced, and torture will not bring about peace. It will not bring an end to anything, nor, by the way, will senseless violence and all the rest of it. So it doesn't surprise me that far too many people think that torture is okay under certain circumstances. I'm quite sure, by the way, if a member of my family were in immediate danger, I would change my view if I thought I could get an answer out of you by hurting you as to where they were and to make them safe. But that's precisely why we don't leave decisions to single people.
Yeah. Oh, finally, to end on a lighter note, Marcus.
Yeah, yeah, come on.
So you've...
Let's brighten this shit up, yo.
You've been playing at the Bedford in Balham for how many years?
Oh, wow. Since the mid-90s, so about 20 years or something.
Wow. And what does it mean to you?
Oh, I love this place. It's great. I've just moved to Balham, so this is going to be more and more important to me. This is a unique little club here, not so little actually, in that it's in just a bit of London, and here it is. This could be anywhere, but it isn't. It's in Balham, and they do two shows a night, and both rooms are full with amazing comedians who really want to come and play here because they've always loved it, because it's just a well-run place where the audience gets it. So I love it. I love it. And the comedy festival's great, because what they did here is they said, recession's kicked in. Fewer people are coming to the live shows. What do? Do we cut back? Ah, no, we do the exact opposite. We throw ourselves at this and we put on a festival and we go, here we are. Here's a great thing for you, everybody. Come and see this. And, you know, it works. It brings people to the club the rest of the year. The government should look at this model.
Well, Marcus, thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
Your show was amazing. I can't wait to see it up in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I just hope you don't sustain any more injuries in the course of comedy.
No more injuries.
Thank you very much. If you're interested in learning more about human rights or joining Amnesty International, then please go to our website, amnesty.org.uk, and make sure you don't miss our next episode. Here's a sneak peek.
If I were in power for a day, I would immediately bring in a massively complex Bill of Rights to stop me from doing the things that I would do if I were in power. Because I think that's the thing about power, it needs to be restrained. Because there's all things that we would do if we had power, but that doesn't mean that we should do those things. You know, I'm quite a vengeful person. I'd be like Stronikov in Dr. Zhivago. All sorts of people would be jailed if I were in power.